Okay, welcome to the beginning of year four. And what we decided to do this time is we're going to go through a review of everything that happened during the last 3 years. And we'll do that in 1 hour, hopefully. Okay, now, by way of introduction, there is no person sitting here today who does not have some sort of a barrier, some sort of a mountain that they've got to climb. Either a financial obstacle, a psychological obstacle, an emotional obstacle, some sort of physical obstacle. Every single person here is experiencing, to some degree, some sort of a crisis in their life, which it seems like it's impossible to get out of. And the question is, do we just make peace with these mountains that surround us, or is there another way? Is there another path? The approach that we're learning together is an approach that was put forth by the Mashgiach, the spiritual supervisor of the Mir Yeshiva in Poland, Rabbi Ruchem Lwowitz. And Rabbi Ruchem Lwowitz gave one class that went on for about 2 years. And during that one class that went on for about 2 years, he gave it every single day for about 2 years, he explained that a person is given a choice in life. They can live within nature, or they can soar beyond. And if they want to soar beyond, there's a technology, there's a path, there's a tool that was handed down to the Jews at Mount Sinai. And that tool is a tool which enables you to levitate, to go beyond the mountains, to lift yourself up above the obstacles. And then he proceeded to list off exactly how that system works. And that's the system that we're reviewing right now. Today we're going to try to go through the 10 initial points in his essays, in his book. Rabbi Ruchem starts off and he says like this. He says that there's a scene in the Torah in which Jacob goes to confront his brother Esav, his evil brother Esav. And the Torah goes into great detail about how he took precautions to ensure that he would survive this confrontation. He prayed, he prepared immense gifts, and the gifts were prepared with extraordinary care to the, and attention to the packaging. He sent sheep and livestock to his brother Esav to try to impress him. And the oral tradition describes how he spread the sheep out in waves, calculating out the curvature of the earth, the distance that Esav would be standing. It would all blur into one massive sea of apparent sheep. And in this way, make an immense impression. This was Madison Avenue at its best. So he prayed, he prepared these gifts, and he also prepared for war. In case everything didn't work out, he was ready with the arms so that he could actually fight back and perhaps triumph against his brother if his brother decided that he wanted to attack. Rabbi Ruchem quotes Nachmanides, the Ramban, saying, why is it that Yaakov did all these things? After all, Jacob was a prophet, and he had been told by God that he was going to be the father of a great nation. 12 tribes would descend from him. Eventually, they would become millions and millions of people. They would inhabit the world. They'd be a light unto the nations. He had to survive. It was a prophecy. He was going to survive. So he was going to survive. Then why do you have to do all these preparations? And Nachmanides says, because we have a principle, you cannot depend on a miracle. Now, that's the setup. Why did Jacob make all these efforts? You can't depend on a miracle. Rabbi Ruchem Lwowitz stands up and he says, Nachmanides, what are you talking about? What miracle? Here you have Jacob, who's a very nice person, and he's articulate, and he's sincere, the height of sincerity. And he approaches his brother and says, my brother, I love you. I just want to be your ally. Let's work together. I will never attack you. I will never have a conflict with you. I will always be supportive of you. Rabbi Ruchem asks, If you have two brothers who had a fight, is it a miracle if they get together a few hours before Yom HaKippurim and one says, I'm really sorry, I apologize. And the other one says, you know what, is that a miracle if he says, I forgive you, let's get it together? That's a miracle? What kind of miracle do you need here? Is it a miracle if you have, he used the example, that there's a thief who breaks into a house and he wants to, and then the owner of the house suddenly shows up and he puts a gun to his head and he says, I'm going to kill you, I'm going to take it. And the owner of the house says, please, I have children. Please don't kill me. Is it a miracle if the robber has mercy on this person and doesn't kill him? I mean, after all, we all believe people change. People change. So fine, he came to do something bad, but he changed. He decided to do something nice, and he's going to let the man go. Would it be a miracle if Esav decided to forgive his brother Jacob, let it go, and they would just become friends? Is it a miracle? And Reb Ruchem Levavitz drops a bomb. He says, you know what? Yeah. It's a miracle if a selfish, cruel person who's only interested in what makes his life comfortable, his whole aspiration is to acquire wealth, power, honor, that he decides to be sweet, that's a miracle. Why? People cannot change. You are who you are. You will never be different. The guts of a human being are in place forever. They are permanent. Therefore, if they changed, it would be a miracle. Reb Ruchem Levavitz starts off his book saying, you want to change? Impossible. It will never happen. You are who you are who you are. For you to change, it would require a miracle. And then Reb Ruchem Levavitz says, thank God we believe in miracles. And he says, you want a miracle? I'll show you exactly how to do it. He goes on and makes one last point in this regard. He says, there are big miracles and there are small miracles. So what are we going to learn how to do? We're going to learn how to perform a big miracle or a small miracle. What's the difference? So he says, Jacob couldn't depend on a miracle and therefore had to make all these efforts, because it would be a miracle if Jacob's brother Esav became sweet. For a person to change, that's an immense miracle. And Jacob wasn't willing to depend on that. However, Reb Ruchem Levavitz points out that we have stories about Yaakov, Jacob, when he was traveling in Israel, and he would get to the Jordan River, and he would go to cross the Jordan River, his socks would never get wet. He would walk into the Jordan, and he counted on the fact that every time he crossed the Jordan, it would split like the Red Sea. And he never worried to take off his socks. He never had to worry his shoes were going to get a little damp. Jacob depended and counted on and was 100% certain of constant little miracles like the Red Sea splitting. The Red Sea splitting, that's no big deal. For a human being to change, oh my goodness. Why? The more closeness in the physical world is measured by inches. Closeness in the spiritual world is measured by similarity. The more similar two things are, the more spiritually close they are. The one creature on planet Earth that is most similar to God is the human being. We are created, B'Tselem Elohim, we were created in God's image. There's no creature that's anywhere near as much like God as we are. God's most obvious character trait is his permanence. He is who he is, he never changes. Therefore, a human being so close to God is the most permanent of all creatures. A tree can change. Dogs and cats, no problem. Yeah? human beings that are so much like God, because they're so much like God, they're very permanent. For a human being to change would require an immense miracle. That's the kind of miracle that we're going to learn to perform. And once you have the ability to change yourself, then small things like walking across the sea and having it split, that's no big deal. Okay, that's his introduction. Point number one on your sheet, is it possible for a person to change within nature? You'd have to rise to the level of the supernatural. That's what we're going to learn how to do. Point number two. There is a passage in the Ethics of the Fathers, in Pirkei Avos, which says as follows. It says, how precious are the Jews, Chaviv in Yisrael, how precious are the Jews? For they were given a precious instrument, the Kli Chemda, a precious instrument with which the world was created. Okay, now, what is this precious instrument that we were given? We were given the Torah. The scroll in that ark is what God used to create the universe. So like, why is it so wonderful that we possess this thing? It's, you know, it's a famous artifact. Yeah, it's like, you know, that I've got the thing that created the world. Like, I could open up a museum. Obviously not. Why is that it's so important that we've got that? So the answer is like this. When God created the world, he took out a device called Torah. He flipped it on. Okay, now, this thing called Torah is a nature creator. So God took it and he went, and he created heaven and earth. Okay, now, this is a heaven and earth creator. If this is a heaven and earth creator, if it can create all of nature, then in theory, if I took this thing and I pointed at myself and I flipped it on, in theory, I could change my own nature. He starts off by saying, the reason it's so important that we possess the device that created heaven and earth, that created all of nature, is because you've got to know that with this exact same device, you can go back in and you can change your nature. And therefore, he says, the first prerequisite to creating this miracle of personal change, to being able to rise above nature, is you got to plug the thing in. You must be connected to the power source, which is Torah. To the extent that someone is involved in this thing called Torah, to that extent he can change. By the way, that's what God had in mind. When God dropped Torah onto the planet 3,300 years ago, he wasn't trying to create religious people, right? That wasn't the goal, right? We want people who are going to be members of the Jewish religion. That wasn't the intention. The intention was he created a whole natural world. He drops all of mankind into the world of nature, and he says, your job is to rise to the surface. Your job is to lift yourself out of the realm of the natural and move into the realm of the supernatural. You were not created to be natural. You have this sense. Every person here, if I told you at the beginning of this year when I said, you can't change, there's a small voice inside of you that says, I can. If I tell you, you're limited, there's a voice inside of you that says, I'm not limited. Now, of course, in the university they teach you, there's only two factors. There's nature and there's nurture. There's genes and environment. Your genes are in place, they're not going to go away. Yeah? You are dumped into this environment, and once you're in that environment, then that's who you're going to be. So the university tells you, you are locked in. But there's a still, small voice that says, it's not true. And that's because God pre-programmed you to know that you can get out. And the purpose of giving the Torah was to enable you to rise above the realm of the natural. When a baby pops out of the womb, he says, feed me, keep me warm, cuddle with me, right? Take care of me in the middle of the night, and if you do not do all this, I will blast your ears out. The nature of a child is he comes into the world selfish, essentially insensitive, cruel. He's on a trajectory. And if the child never gets off that trajectory, if he doesn't veer, then what you end up with 50 years later is a 50-year-old baby. Selfish, take care of me, do all this, and if not, I will blast your ears out. This is a human being in natural form. That is a human being within nature. But we don't have to remain in that state. That's not the goal. The goal is to become a hero, a person who is infused with altruism, a giver, a lover, someone whose life ethic is, I'm here to make your dreams come true. That's what a human being is supposed to look like. But we don't come into the world looking like that. And the whole goal is to rise above our nature and get to the realm of the supernatural. Very often, people say, you know, you have to forgive that trait. It's natural. Anger is natural. You don't do what I want you dead. That's natural. Or if not dead, at least I don't have to talk to you again. Or even if I'm going to talk to you, but I'm not going to talk to you sincerely. And if I talk to you sincerely, I won't talk to you about that issue. Right? This is all natural behavior. It's natural to eat too much, to drink too much, to drive too fast. It's natural to touch things that don't belong to you. All of this is natural behavior. That's not the goal. People say, you know, this particular behavior, it must be okay because it's a natural behavior. We've demonstrated with laboratory rats. So it must be okay. And comes the Torah and says, no, the fact that it's natural only means it's your starting point. You're not a natural creature. You're a pre-supernatural creature. And the Torah comes to lift you up and help you get up to who you really are. That's number two. The Torah creates and recreates nature. Okay. So step one, we've got to be learning. We have to be involved in some sort of Torah study. That's the electricity. That's how you plug it in. You're learning Torah. You're ready to start playing. Step number one of the game is on your sheet, item number three. Item number three is sacrifice. How does this work? Yeah. When Jacob went out to battle, he prepared himself for three things. He got gifts ready to try to bribe his brother. He prayed. But he assembled an army. Now, when he assembled that army, he intended to go out and fight. When he intended to go out and fight, he was planning on being involved in something which in Hebrew is called milchama. They usually translate that as war. But milchama has a very specific intention. Wars during biblical times, in fact, wars until very recently in history, were not like any of the wars that we fight today. Today, when we go to war for something, we're going to war for something, not principle. We want the oil. Or we want the military base, or we want the land. There's some resource that we're going to war for, and the whole goal is to ensure that you conquer in order to get that resource. And by the way, if we cannot get that resource, it is common sense that you would never fight the war. There is no reason that this country or any country on the planet today would ever go to war knowing they're going to lose the war, because the whole point is to win and to get the resource. Today, our highest goal is the acquisition of resources. Once upon a time, that's not how people fought wars. In the old days, this is so hard to imagine. When we think of these people, they seem crazy to us. All wars were religious wars, or they were wars for the king. When you went to war for the king, or when you went to war in a religious war, you went to war even if you knew you were going to lose. Why am I going to war? I'm going to war for the honor of the king, knowing I will die. Or I'm going to war for the honor of my religious beliefs, knowing that I'm going to die. There was a concept called self-sacrifice. Okay. That concept is entirely foreign to the natural world that we live in. In nature, the whole point is survival of the fittest. It's all about hanging in there, never losing. And if you're going to play and lose, you don't play. the concept that there's a principle that's worth more than my life is so foreign to us that when we hear about people who would give up their life for something, we assume they're not psychologically well. Because no psychologically well person would ever have anything in their life worth dying for. But by the way, already when I start to use this vocabulary, you start to see that people who have nothing worth dying for have impoverished lives because they don't possess anything that's more valuable than their life. For we as Westerners, can you imagine if there was something that you owned which was even more valuable than life itself? It's like it's incomprehensible there could be anything that precious. But once upon a time, people felt that there were things that were more precious than life itself, things that were worth dying for. Rebuchim explains that if you want to live in the realm of the supernatural, you have to start acting not naturally. You must leave natural sorts of behaviors. The natural behavior is that you protect yourself and your comfort and your wealth. You protect this sweet lifestyle at any cost. And comes Rebuchim and says that if you want to move into the realm of the supernatural, you have to overcome that urge. You have to be willing to sacrifice. He says that there's a scene in the Torah where Abraham has a nephew, Lot, who gets kidnapped. Abraham hears that his nephew was kidnapped, and out of appreciation, out of appreciation, he pulls out a sword and he runs off to war against five kings. Now, kings usually don't stand around fighting alone. That's five separate armies in order to spring his nephew Lot loose, in order to get him out. Okay. What are the odds that Abraham is going to survive a war against five separate armies? It's suicide. Why did he do it? Rebuchim explains, he had a value that was higher, appreciation. You know, I owe him. And because I owe him, then even if it costs me my life, I'm going to try to save him. So Rebuchim says, what kind of religion is this? I mean, you and I know how Judaism feels about this. Judaism says there's only three cardinal sins. There are only three things you got to die for. You have to die rather than kill somebody else. If someone puts a gun to your head and says, kill him or I'll kill you. So you all know the Jewish law says you should say, listen, I prefer that you not kill me. But there are certain experiences that are so degrading, it's better not to wake up on the other side of them, and one of them is killing another person. Therefore, I'm not going to kill him. So you can do whatever you're going to do, but I'm not going to kill this person. Or rape. There are certain experiences it's better not to live through. And therefore, if someone puts a gun to my head and says, do this terrible thing to this person, I say, listen, I prefer that you don't kill me, but I'm not going to do that to her. We know there's three cardinal sins, that and idol worship. It's also we don't experience idol worship in the West today, so you can't imagine how degraded idol worship is. If you travel to certain parts of Central Africa today, you can actually see it. It's so degraded. Certain things are not worth waking up on the other side of. And therefore, a person puts a gun to your head and says, worship this idol or I'll kill you. You say, listen, I wish you wouldn't kill me, but I'm not going to worship an idol, right? Illicit sexual relations, killing other people, idol worship. We know three cardinal sins, you die rather than do those. Whoever said that out of appreciation, you give up your life, explains Rebuchim Lubavitch. There has to be an element of self-sacrifice in the fulfillment of every commandment. Whenever you are trying to fulfill God's command, there's got to be some degree of sacrifice. Otherwise, it will not have that magical effect of lifting you up out of the realm of the natural. You're still living a natural life if you're not willing to sacrifice. What is sacrifice for us? Sacrifice might be that you slept 5,000 miles across the Atlantic to come all the way from London to here to Los Angeles to hear me speak today. Thank you very much, JLE, for coming. Yes. Yeah. Self-sacrifice, yeah. Seriously, you get up early in the morning and you run off to hear your Torah class. That's self-sacrifice. You have to pay for parking. Cost you $2. That's sacrifice. Yeah? You had to sit in an uncomfortable chair. The room was too crowded. It was hot. That's called self-sacrifice. It doesn't have to be you give up your life, but in every fulfillment of God's will, there has to be some element of sacrifice, or it's not plugged in, it's not magical, it won't lift you out of that realm. If everything is sweet and comfortable and there's no sacrifice whatsoever, then there's no magic. Today, a kid heads off to university, and the child expects that my parents will pay for university. And if the university is away from home, then he expects my parents will pay for a dorm for me to live in or for an apartment. And I live far from the university. My parents have to buy me a car. And then when I graduate from university, I expect I'm going to get a high-paying job. I'm not going to work for $3 an hour. I graduate from university. I expect to come in as, if not the CEO, but at least, you know, right, you know, some important position in the company. There's all these expectations. It should be easy. Like that's the way that it should work. You know, you graduate from law school and you get the job. Okay, today people are waking up. That's not reality. That's not the way that it actually works. And certainly, for my parents and my grandparents and my great grandparents and my great grandparents, they never knew such a thing. Yeah, they started in every generation with nothing. And they worked like dogs. They slaved away to try to put food on the table, and it wasn't comfortable. And they did anything they could do to make things work. And in addition to that, they kept Shabbos. So that when the guy hired them in New York and said, you know, I'll hire you, but I hope you're not one of those religious Jews, and on Saturday the guy doesn't show up, and when he shows back up on Sunday, the employer says, you're fired. So every week you had to go get a new job. That's the way that it used to be. To keep Shabbos, you had to lose your job every week. Today, we're starting to get back into the reality that to accomplish something in life, it requires sacrifice. It's not going to be easy. Certainly, to accomplish something in spirituality, if there isn't sacrifice, it will not happen. These are not popular words. That's why most people live natural lives and end up caught in the trap. They're like the mouse on the wheel and they can't get off. Because unless you lift yourself up out of the natural world by sacrificing, you're stuck. You're locked in. Next item on your list, beyond sacrifice. There's a spectacular and confusing medrash, a story that's brought down in the Jewish oral tradition that describes the Jews fleeing Egypt when they escaped from Egypt. There were 10 plagues. In the midst of these 10 plagues, Pharaoh ejects the Jews, get out of here. In one day, 3 million people flee the country. They go running through the desert. As fast as they can, they get away from Egypt. They're running. Boom! They hit the Dead Sea. That means the Red Sea. They get to the Red Sea. That's it. Massive hurricane. They can't cross. They turn around to try to go take a land route. Lions, tigers, and bears. They can't go this way, there's a hurricane. They can't go that way, it's lions, tigers, and bears. The only place they can head is back to... Oh my God. They turn around, and there he is, coming over the hill, none other than the Pharaoh himself, Hitler, with his army. The man who wants us all dead. And the chariots are coming down the hill. And the Jews burst out in prayer, and the verse says... Uparo hikriv. In the English translations, it always says, and Pharaoh drew close. He approached. Okay. But you know Hebrew grammar. Uparo hikriv. The hey of hikriv is causative. Literally, the phrase uparo hikriv means, and paro, Pharaoh, caused closeness. What's the verse talking about? And then it dives into this incredible metaphor. There was a prince who was wandering through a forest. And as the prince was wandering through a forest, he heard screams. He rode his horse towards the screams, and as he rides his horse towards the screams, there's this young maiden, a princess, and she's there, and she's being abused by these terrible robbers who are trying to steal from her. The prince sees the scene. He rides in on his horse. He knocks over the robbers. He picks up the princess, puts her on a horse, and rides off into the sunset. The whole time, she's saying, "You saved me. You saved me." He says, "I know." Yeah, right? So they ride off towards his castle. He takes her to the castle. He really would like to ask her to marry him. But he feels like, "Now, I can't ask her today. It's abusive. She just had this rough day. She'll say yes because she's so emotionally moved. Let her calm down for a couple of days. Then I'll like pop the question." He takes her back to the palace. He says, "Listen, the west wing is yours." He gives all of his servants instructions to take care of her, right? They bring her beautiful clothing. They make her spectacular meals. Any kind of entertainment she needs, they take care of. A week goes by, 2 weeks goes by. He doesn't hear anything from her. After a while, he sends a message. He says, "Could you ask the princess if it's possible I could speak with her?" The servant comes back, and he says, "I asked her. She says she's busy right now. She can't talk." She's busy. What is she doing? She's studying for her GREs. Yeah. So he says, "You know, tell her I really want to speak to her." He sends message after message, and she can't. She's redecorating. Yeah. She's not going to give him the time of day. Prince only has one option. Prince sits down at the table, and all of his most trusted officers are sitting around the table. And he says, "Gentlemen, you understand what needs to be done." They all nod. He says, "Tomorrow, 3:00 in the Rose Garden. See you there." Next day, she's taking her usual walk through the Rose Garden, 3:00 in the afternoon. Suddenly, out of no place, all the king's men, dressed up like bandits, right, go running after her. She screams, "Ah, help me, help me!" On cue, the prince rides in on his horse, knocks over all of his own men, right, picks her up, puts her on his horse, rides off into the sunset. She says, "You saved me, I love you." He says, "Will you marry me?" She says, "Yes, exactly, okay, here we go, okay." The Midrash says, that's what it means, "And Paro drew close." That Pharaoh drew the Jews close to God again. Tells the whole story. When the Jews were in Egypt, it was rough. There were people being killed. They were being hit with whips. And they cried out to God, "Please, please save us." And God said, "Fine, I'll come and I'll save you." And he made 10 plagues and he ejected the Jews out of Egypt. And he said, "Come with me, I'm going to take you to Mount Sinai." But then they were wandering through the desert and they were eating manna and everything was great and they were relaxed and they didn't feel the need to call out to him anymore. Everything was good. Let's be straight. Do you pray differently when you're facing crisis than on an ordinary day? So the Jews had relaxed. They'd relaxed. And they weren't crying out to him. And God said, "I only want closeness with you. I want you to live with me." And they're just like, "We're busy right now." So God said, "I have one choice. I'm going to send Pharaoh, right, my trusted servant, and he'll rekindle the relationship." That's why God sent him. End of story. Steps in Rabbi Ruchel Lubavitch from Mir and says, "Hey, wait a minute. What's going on here?" He says, "Isn't it true that the purpose of prayer is to get us out of trouble? So anytime you got your back up against a wall, man, those Egyptians are coming, I'm about to die, the response is pray." And the tool of prayer was given so that when you have your back up against a wall, you have a rope ladder to climb out. But if that's the case, then why do you really need prayer? I mean, after all, just have God not cause the problem in the first place. If there would be no cancer, if there would be no financial crisis, if all of my kids would be doing fine, if I could just get married, right? What do I need prayer for? So why create crises and then teach us to pray? Just don't create crises. Ruchem says, look back at the story. It's not that first comes a crisis and the way to get out of it is prayer. It's that the whole goal is prayer. What is prayer? So the Targum Yonasan, the Aramaic commentary on the Torah, translates the words that he v'yikra b'shem Hashem, he called out in God's name. He translates those words as, right, v'tzali b'shem Hashem, he prayed in God's name. That is, praying and calling out are the same thing. What does it mean, praying and calling out are the same thing? This morning, I live in Eretz Yisrael, I live in Israel. And I have this amazing, amazing device. My favorite piece of technology in the entire world, yeah, is my link back to my wife. Yeah, right? My Samsung, yeah? And this is precious to me because I can get on this and I can talk to the one that I love. This morning I called, no answer. So I said, this is your husband, your only husband, the one you love. Yeah, calling, right? I'll talk to you later. I said, when I started the message, I said, Chana. I called her name, and then I left my message. When you call somebody's name, that's an act of intimacy. Chana, Chana, that's an act of intimacy. Prayer is not a means to an end. It's an act of intimacy. Now, the reason why we don't relate to prayer that way is not because we're not religious. That's not the reason. If only that was the problem. Religiosity, that's an easy thing to fix. The reason that we don't relate to prayer that way is not because we're not religious, it's because we are non-intimate. We live in a generation that isn't interested in relationships and closeness anymore. You see, relationships and efficiency are mutually exclusive. You cannot have both. If you want to have closeness, you've got to have time well wasted. And we are so busy being productive. We pride ourselves. I've been up since 3 this morning. I went to sleep at 1:30. I worked all day. Coffee, IV, yeah? That's what makes me a man, is the fact that I'm so efficient. My children? Yeah, I saw them 6 years ago. Yeah, I'm a man to the extent that I don't have a relationship with my wife because I'm so busy. And a woman is so proud because she maintains her independence. You start to see the sickness of the society? That independence is the goal. More than that, I have a friend who's a psychologist. He's a fantastic psychologist. We have schmoozes every now and then. I was telling her that, you know, I'm so in love with my wife that I can comfortably say I couldn't live without her. She says, that's a psychological disorder today. It's called codependence. The problem is not that we're not religious. The reason that I can't relate to prayer is because I'm not a person of intimacy. Watch this. The whole goal here is to move from the realm of the natural to the realm of the supernatural. In the natural world, there is something, I admit, there is something in the natural world called procreation. But there ain't no such thing as love. Love is supernatural. It's a gift of God. It only exists when you move out of the realm of the natural. In the natural world, survival of the fittest. The selfish gene. Me first. I'm not happy. Wah, wah. It's all self-focused. That's natural. To be in a state where the only thing that matters is that I want to make your dream come true. That is not a natural state. That's a supernatural state. Why did God create the universe? It's not because he needed anything. God is a lover with a capital L. He just wants to give and take care of and make dreams come true. And he is the model that we're trying to follow. Therefore, if you want to move into the realm of the supernatural, Rabbi Rucham says, you must be involved not only in Torah and sacrifice, you must be involved in prayer. You got to talk to God. I'll tell you a story. Several years ago, I wrote a book on parenting. And the book that I wrote talked about three very important principles in parenting. Planting, which is a cognitive process, building, which is a behavioral process, and prayer. And I explained that if you want to bring forth the potential of another human being, whether that other human being is a child or a spouse or a student or even yourself, you have to be involved in this cognitive process, this behavioral process, and prayer. Prayer is the key third ingredient. The book, the manuscript, got a tremendous amount of attention, and three networks, ABC, CBS, and NBC, all said they wanted to cover the release of the book, and they wanted to know if I would go on talk shows. So in my great modesty, I said no, but okay if you force me. And I ended up going on about 100 talk shows across America. When they presented in order to do this, you actually have to be represented by a PR firm, so Reuter Finn represented me, and Reuter Finn came to me, and they said that, you know, we're happy to take your case, and we're very excited, we think it's going to be a great book. In fact, they told me in advance, most people don't realize this, they said it's going to be a bestseller. So I said, how do you know? They said, well, they explained to me the whole process, that bestsellers don't happen spontaneously. A bestseller is actually chosen by the PR firm together with the publishing companies, and they schedule the release of bestsellers spread out enough so the market can handle the influx of cash each time when they release a bestseller. They don't want to release bestsellers too close to each other. So your book is going to be a bestseller, and so we're going to train you. We're going to give you television training so you know how to appear on television, how to speak, how you have to dress. You can't wear a white shirt on television because white bleeds out with a color camera, and therefore you have to have a shirt that's a little bit off white. And how to speak, and you never cross. All sorts of interesting television training. And one last thing, when you present your book, we're very interested that you present, we noticed there's three principles: planting, building, the cognitive, the behavioral, and prayer. So we think America is going to go wild over those first two principles, and we really recommend that you speak about planting and building a lot. The cognitive and the behavioral, talk about that. So I said, what do you mean? And they said, we're sure you understand. So I said, listen, I can't betray the tradition. The tradition was always that there's three things that are required. This was a Jewish belief, that if you want to bring forth human potential, you plant, you build, and you pray. So the representative from Reuter Finn, she told me, she said, we're sure that you'll make a different decision. And you have to know that if you mention the word prayer on national television, we will drop your book. So we're sure that you will make the right decision. Fine. My book was scheduled for release in August. But because of another bestseller, they ended up delaying it, and 16,000 copies of this book sat in a New York warehouse for an extra month while we waited for a September release. And it was making me crazy because it was such a good book and I wanted it to get out and really help people. And the representative from Reuter Finn said, I'm sorry, just relax, you'll have to wait. Fine, so my first appearance was going to be on the CBS Morning Show, and I packed up my valise and I'm ready to go, and I flew to New York, ready to present the book. The only thing was, I presented the book in late September 2001, and just a few days before I arrived, there was this terrible accident in New York, and two buildings fell down. And when I arrived in New York, there were banners hanging from the buildings that said, "Pray to God." I went on this show on CBS, and the interviewer started asking me, you know, I see you have a principle called planting, what is that? And I explained the cognitive process. I see you have another principle called building, could you explain that? And I explained the behavioral process. She said, I see that you have a third principle, do you want to speak about that? And the representative from Reuter Finn was standing behind a glass window next to my best friend, right, going, yeah? My best friend was going. And I said, yeah, there is a third principle. She said, I see, it's called prayer. Do you want to talk about what exactly that is? And I turned to this lady and I said to her, tell me something. Are there circumstances that you never want your children to experience? And there was this deep contemplation, this moment of silence. And her eyes got wet and she said, yes. There are circumstances I never want my children to experience. And I said to her, tell me something. Are there people that you never want your children to meet? And she said with tears in her eyes, yes, there are people I never want my children to meet. And I said to her, tell me something. Be honest. How much control do you have over whether your children experience those circumstances or meet those people? And she said, none. And I said, today, if you do not pray for your children, you are insane. And she said, yes, you're right. And my friend went, The second principle here is the principle you have Torah, you have sacrifice, you have prayer. Today, if you do not speak to someone bigger than yourself, if you don't turn to an almighty God today, you are insane. And more than that, you're locked into a world where there is no intimacy, there is no closeness. The next principle that Reb Ruchem introduced, and this is a fascinating principle, is that there are really two separate expressions of the divine will. One expression, which we're all familiar with, is at Mount Sinai, 3,300 years ago, God delivered to the Jewish nation that book, the Torah. And the Torah is passed down from generation to generation, teacher to student, father to son, mother to daughter, throughout the generations. And until today, the Jews are walking through history carrying this tradition from Mount Sinai. That is one revelation of God's will. But there's another. At every single moment, a human being is capable of tapping into ongoing prophecy. And there are many, many, many people, we're talking about millions on planet Earth, who experience this on a daily basis. The prophetic organ in the human being, the one that allows you to tap into this second revelation of God's will, is called the cerebrum. It's your intellect. And God whispers into your intellect his will. That's called common sense. Or in the language of the sages, it's called derech eretz, the way the world functions. A human being is obligated to follow God's will, both the Torah and this other revelation, which you can get constantly just by thinking. A person is obligated, Reb Ruchem Lubavitch says, to be reasonable and rational. Now, of course, sometimes there's a conflict between what it says in that book and what's reasonable and rational. It's reasonable and rational that you should, for example, eat every single day. Otherwise, your blood sugar will drop, it'll mess up your metabolism. There's lots of good reasons to eat every single day. But it says in that book that you don't eat on Yom Kippur. So whenever there's a conflict between the supernatural revelation and the natural revelation, the supernatural revelation always wins. But unless there's a conflict, you are required by Jewish law to listen to Derech Eretz, to listen to the intellect, the common sense. And Reb Ruchem Lubavitch says that it is no less of a spiritual achievement to follow your intellect and live reasonably as it is to keep any there. He says there's no difference between keeping kosher or keeping Shabbos on one hand. And on the other hand, when you write out a check to mark in your check register the amount of the check so your next check doesn't bounce. To not eat a high salt, high fat diet. To follow what's obvious and reasonable. When you park your car, put money in the parking meter so you don't get a ticket. Live intelligently. You're going to drive a car, put on a seatbelt. To live logically, he says, is a religious obligation, and more than religious obligation, he says, it's part of the ladder that you climb to get out of the world of the natural. And he explains like this. These two revelations are not side by side. They're not parallel. Rather, you have to flip it like shaking your Android. And what happens is, you end up with, at the bottom level, there is the world of Derech Eretz, the world of logic, the world of living a reasonable life. On top of that, you have supernatural laws like keep kosher, keep Shabbos, and cover your elbows. And he says, you cannot ascend into the world of the supernatural until you have mastered the world of the natural. Derech Eretz Kadma LaTorah, the world of the logical, always precedes and comes before the world of the supernatural. When Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, one of the greatest sages of the previous generation, used to give his rabbinical ordination, he would bring in one of these Talmud scholars who wanted ordination. They feared Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky's smicha. It was extremely difficult. He would always lead off with a question that would knock all the guys out. He would say, tell me something. How do you get from here to First and Broadway? And if the kid couldn't answer that question, he says you expect people to trust you with their spiritual lives, you don't even have to navigate your way around the neighborhood? If you haven't mastered the world of the natural, you can't ever ascend into the world of the supernatural. Rabbi Yochanan Lubavitch says, the intellect is like a Rebbe. It's like a teacher, an older brother that was given to you to guide you in life. It was given to you by God, and you must listen to the intellect. He says the next step in ascending out of the world of the natural is you must first master the natural by living a reasonable, logical, good life. Next step. He explains. There's supernatural law, the 613 commandments, and there's natural law. Again, live reasonably. He says, there are two differences between these two bodies of law. The first difference, he says, is latitude, and the second difference, he says, is mercy. In either system, if you violate the law, there are consequences. But the consequences are very different. How? If a person eats one small microscopic piece of pig, he has violated supernatural law. That's problematic. If I go for a short 30-meter drive up the street without a seatbelt on, it's possible I have not yet violated natural law. It could be that what I've done is not so dangerous that I've actually done something completely irrational. Now, of course, if I get on an LA freeway and I drive for 30 minutes on LA freeway without a seatbelt, I'm insane. Yeah, that's a violation of natural law. It turns out that by supernatural law, if I light just one candle only 15 minutes after the sun sets, I've already violated the Sabbath. But I can eat a little bit of salty food, and I haven't necessarily violated the laws of nature. There's more latitude when it comes to natural law than when it comes to supernatural law. So in a way, natural law is much more easygoing than supernatural law. But on the other hand, when I violate a supernatural law, I eat a piece of pig. That generates consequences. Someone eats a piece of pig, their life is not going to be as sweet and smooth as it would have been had they not eaten that piece of pig. But the result will not hit immediately. If I eat a piece of pig, the result of that may not hit for 50 years. It could be that 50 years later, I experience some circumstance as a result of having eaten that piece of pig. In that way, supernatural law is pretty easygoing. It gives you a lot of time to fix up a mistake that you've made. Not true about natural law. You know, the second that you violate natural law, the moment that you violate natural law, instantly the consequence comes. And therefore, it's a little bit scary to violate natural law because there is no time to fix things up. You violate natural law, you know it immediately. Moving down our list. The next step, he says, is you have to strike the appropriate balance between trust in God and making your own natural efforts. What is that balance? It's very interesting. Most people think the balance is that if you have a lot of trust in God, then you actually don't have to make much of a natural effort because, after all, God will come through for you. That's sort of like a religious personality. Religious people think that way. Rucham Avavit shows from many, many sources it's not true. He says, what is trust in God? And he quotes a famous book, the Chovos HaLevavos, the Duties of the Heart. He says, trust in God means that you do every single possible effort that you can make in order to make this thing happen. You have a dream, you sweat over it. 24/7 you're working for that thing. You give it everything that you've got. Well, where's the trust in God? When your dream comes true, after all those efforts, you admit, I really had nothing to do with it. In the end, it was really just a miracle that God dropped into my lap. I have a number of students who are financially very, very successful. And they've made millions. And the one common thread that I find among all of my students who are millionaires is all of them are the first to confess that, you know, I just got lucky. It just fell into my lap because I was making all these efforts over here and then it just popped up from over there. Anyone who's had wild success in any area of their life knows they didn't do it. Talk to people who write books. If the book's a bestseller, they'll tell you it was the strangest thing. I was typing and it was me typing, but it was not my words going down onto the page. Talk to someone who has an amazing medical career, and they'll tell you, this discovery, just like out of the blue, you know, the petri dish had started to rot, and there was like this stuff there, and I put it in bacteria, and it killed the bacteria. It's amazing. Trust in God means that after you put in all of your own natural efforts, you know that it's not you that did it. And he says, trusting in God in this way, knowing that it's not you, that's part of moving into the realm of the world of miracles. As long as you think that you're running the show, you can't experience miracles. There's a certain humility that's required. Moving towards the bottom. The last two elements in making miracles that we've covered in this last 3 years. He explains, you cannot move into the realm of the supernatural unless you work so hard that you are flat on your face, exhausted, finished. He said, that is absolutely required, what he calls yegia. Yegia shneihem, mishkachas avon. If you want to move into the realm of the supernatural, you must be someone who mamish, you give every drop of energy you've got and then 10% more. My children are all long distance runners. And they belong to a runner's club. And in that runner's club, everyone there has run multiple marathons, and some of them run ultra marathons. And of course, you all know that physically, it is impossible to store enough glycogen in your body to make it through 26 miles. It can't be done. At some point, everyone running a marathon runs out of glycogen. When you run out of glycogen, you experience something called the wall. When you experience the wall, every single part of your body starts experiencing extraordinary pain. Your earlobes ache. Everything. And anyone who's ever finished a marathon, if they didn't walk it, they hit the wall and they ran through this immense pain where they had no energy left. And everything in their body was saying, don't lift your leg. And they put another step and another step. And there's something very interesting. Almost without exception, everyone in my children's running club is wildly successful in life. They've all experienced amazing miracles. Success has been dropped into their laps. Now, why is that? Coincidentally, they happen to have acquired a trait of, I give it everything that I've got and I give it 10% more. And when everything hurts and I feel I can't take one more step, I take another 100. That trait is absolutely required if you want to step out of the world of the natural and move into the world of the supernatural. And last but certainly not least, the final element that we spoke about in the last 3 years is in the natural world, there is no such thing as empathy. There can't be empathy in the natural world. If lions empathized with sheep, they would starve. If weeds empathized with the plants they're strangling, they wouldn't exist. Can you imagine an empathetic bacteria? It can't be. The rule in the world of nature is kill or be killed. And therefore, there can't be empathy. Empathy belongs to the realm of the supernatural. And therefore, he says, part of the normal ascent from the world of the natural up into the world of the natural is you must develop an empathy muscle. We know very little about the biography of Moses. Very little. His whole biography is contained in a few lines in the Torah. But here's what we know. This was the beginning of Moses' life, according to the Torah. He's a young guy, and he's growing up in Pharaoh's palace, being raised as an Egyptian. One day he looks out the window, and he sees, right, acres and acres and acres filled with slaves making mud bricks and building pyramids. And he looks out and he says, like, they must be in pain, and it's not enough. He runs out of the house. He runs down to the barbed wire. He gets to the barbed wire. The guards run. He says, Prince, are you sure you... And he says, open the gate. And they say, you know, there's slaves in there. It could be dangerous right now. Open the gate, he says to the guards. The guards open the gate. Moses runs into the fields with the slaves. And you can imagine all the Jews looking up, and they're seeing this Egyptian prince running through the fields. And he runs up to some poor Jew there that's got his shoulder into this mass of brick, and the Jew's pushing the brick, trying to get the brick into place. And Moses leans down, and he puts his shoulder to the brick next to this Jew, and he starts pushing. And the Jew looks at this Egyptian prince, and he says, what are you crazy? What are you doing here? Moses says, I'm going to get you guys out. The Jew says, what are you crazy? You're pushing bricks. You want to get us out? You are in the palace. Go into the palace and speak to them. Moses explains, no one's ever escaped Egypt. If you want to escape Egypt, you need a miracle. In order to get a miracle, you have to experience empathy. I've got to feel your pain. Moses feels their pain. He goes back to the palace. He sees an Egyptian beating a Jew. He feels the pain of the Jew, kills the Egyptian. He has to flee. He runs off to the land of Midian. He gets to Midian. When he gets to Midian, there's a bunch of Midianite women there who are shepherdesses who are trying to feed their sheep, and the men won't let them near the well. Moses feels the pain of these Midianite shepherdesses, and he goes in there and he argues and he gets them their water. He ends up going to work as a shepherd. Look what happened. He empathized with the entire Jewish nation initially. Then he empathized with one Jew. Then he empathized with a group of non-Jews. Finally, he goes to work as a shepherd in Midian. And working there as a shepherd, he's guiding a sheep, and one sheep suddenly bolts. And Moses is trying to care the sheep, but that sheep's running off in this direction. He runs off after this one lost sheep. The sheep runs and runs and runs and runs to a body of water and starts drinking thirstily from the body of water. Moses says, I understand. He ran because he was thirsty. If he's thirsty and he was walking, he must be tired too. And Moses empathizes with a sheep. If he's tired, I can't make him walk back to the flock. Moses picks up this lamb to carry this lamb back to the flock. Feeling the pain of the lamb, he turns around. And there is the burning bush. And the redemption of the Jews begins. If you want miracles, you must move from the world of the cruel into the world of the empathetic, where you actually can feel the other's pain. What we just learned is, it's impossible to get a miracle. Certainly personal change is impossible unless something supernatural takes place. In order for something supernatural to take place, you've got to plug into the supernatural, the Torah. That's the 110 volts. And more than that, you not only have to plug into the Torah, but you must be involved in some sort of sacrifice. Life can't be cushy. You have to be willing to let go a little bit of that which is comfortable. You must be involved in prayer. You have to make sure you also keep the laws of Derech Eretz. You must live an intelligent life as well, not just what we would call a religious life, but an intelligent life. You have to make sure that you strike the proper balance. You make immense efforts to make things happen, and then you admit very humbly, it wasn't me, it was God. There has to be struggle to the point of exhaustion. And finally, we have to move into the world of empathy and feel the pain of others. These are the first 10 of about 30 steps that, when practiced, consistently create miracles here in this world. Big miracles like being able to change yourself, to be able to become everything that you are in potential, and even what we would call small miracles, like just splitting the Red Sea. What we're going to do, God willing, is starting next month, we're going to start learning the 11th step, the next step. And we'll knock off, God willing, about one step a month for the next, it'll probably be about 24 to 36 months until we actually finish learning the whole system. And then you can all go home and practice being wizards. Okay, have a wonderful month. We'll see you, God willing, next month. Take care.